Our second reading is from the 22nd chapter of Matthew. When the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together, and one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. "Teacher, which commandment in the law is the greatest?" He said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the greatest and first commandment. And a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets."
I've been trying to remember to read two short passages of the Bible each day during Lent, and then to say a short prayer. Maybe you've been trying to do the same thing this month as well. We were all invited into this Lenten practice of reading two passages from the Gospel of Matthew and then praying a short request that God might reveal God's self to us, to show us how we might be of use for God's world. Well, I'll confess to you this morning that more than a few of these past 30 days plus, has come and gone. And I've forgotten to do this seemingly simple practice. The first of these two readings is this passage from Matthew that we just heard. We've come to refer to these brief verses as the greatest commandment, from how the Pharisees describe the trap that they're trying to set for Jesus, and Jesus' skillful two-part answer solidifies his standing with his followers, but also sets into motion his fateful arrest, trial, and crucifixion. Love God and love your neighbor is Jesus' summation of all the teachings of Scripture. What Jesus' followers hear and the Pharisees have curiously discovered is so radically inspirational that it threatened to upset every existing place of power, every long-held tradition, and challenge to a status quo that had separated God from God's people for far too long. This is what our Lenten journey has offered us this year, a series of discoveries, on the surface so very simple and yet allowed to roll around in our heads even just for a little while. Well, they're so profound that they contain the power to change the world. Each Sunday this Lent, we've heard from Jesus and a series of notable quotables. Each week, we've revealed something truer about God's story, but also discovering something truer about our own stories, too. This year, we also challenged this community to listen deeply to one another. Five of you answered the call to come and share a story of journey with us on a Wednesday evening during one of our services with Holden Evening Prayer. I'm so very grateful for each storyteller's bravery, their honesty, and their vulnerability. And I'm sure that those who are able to listen in will agree that their truly skillful and artful deliveries made each story resonate all the more. If you weren't able to join us or perhaps missed a week or more, there are recordings available to stream on our website. As I listened along, five seemingly different narratives shared a common thread. Each story of journey was also a story of discovery. No surprise there, really. I mean, journeys, the best ones, take us somewhere that we've never been before and reveal something we didn't know that we needed to know. Deb's story, our last one, was about her trip to Egypt. But that was only the setting. Andrea's story was about the journey her mother took as an infant from Nazi-occupied Europe to here in the U.S. But that was only the context. Both of these physical journeys created opportunity for Deb and Andrea to learn something of deep anthropological and arguably theological importance. Sorry for those big words, but just saying that we learned something about the people and something about God seems to really undersell the depth of what actually occurred in those stories. We learned from Tony's story that princesses aren't just born that way. Well, they're the product of powerful experiences at unexpected times. How is it possible that a whole lifetime of behavioral responses could be dictated by an event that happened when you're only 22 months old? What might we discover about our own lives if we could go back and relive our earliest days? Both Barb and Anne's stories were stories of life and death, and the complicating movements between the two. Barb's discovery of the new life in her son and her own mental disease, which conspired for the opposite. That story advocated for hope in the face of despair. Anne's discovery of the importance of ritual to push back against the defeat of endings, to usher in the importance of new beginnings, allows for life to continue to grow and to flourish. These discoveries, each of them unique, all of them profound, are shaping lives and life still today. I give thanks for these storytellers, each of them. Let's listen to the story now in song as we sing together the first two verses of Were You There?
Our third reading is from the 26th chapter of Matthew. When Jesus had finished saying all these things, he said to his disciples, "You know that after 2 days the Passover is coming, and the Son of Man will be handed over to be crucified." Then the chief priests and the elders of the people gathered in the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas, and they conspired to arrest Jesus by stealth and kill him. But they said, "Not during the festival, or there may be a riot among the people." Now, while Jesus was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, a woman came to him with an alabaster jar of very costly ointment, and she poured it on his head as he sat at the table. But when the disciples saw it, they were angry and said, "Why this waste? For this ointment could have been sold for a large sum and the money given to the poor." But Jesus, aware of this, said to them, "Why do you trouble the woman? She has performed a good service to me. But you always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me. By pouring this ointment on my body, she has prepared me for burial. Truly I tell you, wherever this good news is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in remembrance of her." Then one of the 12, who was called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, "What will you give me if I betray him to you?" They paid him 30 pieces of silver, and from that moment he began to look for an opportunity to betray him.
What would happen if we had stopped our readings this morning after the story of Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem, riding on the donkey under waving palms? What? Well, if your calendar doesn't allow your attendance this coming Thursday and Friday, and if you don't keep your own Easter vigil on Saturday, you'll arrive back here next Sunday to the good news that Jesus is alive. It's really sort of like reading the first chapter of a book and then flipping to the back and reading the happy ending. But there's one big difference for us here in the 21st century. We already know the ending of this story, don't we? We hardly even need to read the opening chapters of the book, and we certainly know what's waiting at its conclusion. Something else altogether is at stake for us when we dive into this story, though. The middle parts. The parts that include a conspiratorial act and a confession that strikes uncomfortably close to the bone. I would suggest that the parts of this story about Jesus that are important for us to know and to relive are not just found in the beginning and at the end. Those parts are mostly about Jesus. It's the parts in the middle, the hard parts. These are the parts about us. Anne's story of her work as a funeral director and getting the deceased where they need to go, that only works when she also helps the families get where they need to be. This is the ritual of Holy Week for us. We don't just listen to this story in order to bring Jesus to the cross so he can then be placed in a tomb, which can then be discovered empty on Easter morning. We listen to this story of betrayal and rejection and sacrifice and death, because it also gets us where we need to be. as much as this story is about God, it's just as much about us, too. Andrea talked about the mysteries of God. Where was God while her grandparents were hiding from the Nazis? Where was God when they were killed at Auschwitz? And if God seemed absent then, how could God not be absent even now? Aren't these mysteries ones that we too wrestle with? When Barb stared down at her newborn son, why did his life not inspire the same kind of joy that all those episodes of TLC's A Baby Story seemingly portrayed? How could something so wonderful make someone feel so unhappy? We need to listen to the hardest parts of this story because they're the parts that belong to us. They're the parts that draw us in. And more importantly, they're the parts that draw us closer to God. We listen to these hard parts because they get us where we need to be. And we have to take Jesus where he needs to go, to the cross.
Today's final reading is from the 27th chapter of Matthew. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters, and they gathered the whole cohort around him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him, and after twisting some thorns into a crown, they put it on his head. They put a reed into his right hand and knelt before him and mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." They spat on him, and they took the reed and struck him in the head. After mocking him, they stripped him of the robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him away to crucify him. As they went out, they came upon a man from Cyrene named Simon. They compelled this man to carry his cross. And when they came to the place called Golgotha, which means place of the skull, they offered him wine to drink, mixed with gall, but when he tasted it, he would not drink it. And when they had crucified him, they divided his clothes among themselves by casting lots. Then they sat down and kept watch over him. Over his head, they put the charge against him, which read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews."
A crown and a scarlet robe. This is how our protagonist gets costumed for what is assumed is the final act. Actually, the robe is only temporary, and even this small comfort is removed as he's nailed to the cross. And more nails hold the sign. In case anyone is left unaware, this is the King. And this is what we do to kings like Jesus. But the surprise that awaits at the end of this journey is that death isn't the end. Our assumptions, our expectations, our understandings of this world are about to be blown apart. Deb discovered this while she was traveling in Egypt and struggling to tolerate people whose true story she never imagined. An act of kindness broke through the facade and something new and delightful emerged. Andrea discovered that if you can find the patience of Job, even the smallest grain of faith can survive and grow into something big and beautiful. And Tony discovered a piece of herself and how it was shaped by something that startled her as a toddler. Making sense of that piece all these years later has led to new healing. And Anne discovered that tending to the endings in a meaningful way allows something new to happen in the beginnings that do follow. And Barb discovered how to choose life over death each new day. This is the story that we are called to be a part of. And it includes the joyful parts and the really hard parts too. This is what our storytellers have helped us to discover. And we too walk with a God that chooses life over death. I mentioned earlier that I've been trying to read two passages each day during Lent. The Great Commandment is the first, and the final verses of Matthew's Gospel are the second. These verses are called the Great Commission, which is Jesus' charge to his followers. Once they've discovered life on the other side of death, but let's not get ahead of ourselves. That story is for next week. Thanks be to God. Amen.
Oh, truth.